Good morning, diners and travelers and drinkers and eaters and what all? Everything today. Yes, and yeah, cooks and cookers. And you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
Yeah, we got that in, right?
We did get that in.
Probably do anyway.
And first up, a really exciting wine adventure that we had. Do you want to present that one, Rabideau?
If I turn my microphone on, I'll do better. Suffice it to say that when we sampled one of the wines that came from Arnaldo Caprai, Marco of that family being our next guest, and declared that it was one of the best bottles of wine she had ever tasted, we found out why, and you can too.
Yes, every time I hear that wonderful Italian accent, which I've just heard from Marco Caprai, I'm yearning to visit Italy again. We have on the phone not only Marco, but Alessandro Boga, who is with a group that we work with quite a lot, Colangelo PR. And we're talking about a very special type of wine.
Now, let me butt in here, because I'm maybe too embarrassed to say this, but and we did already tell Marco and Alessandro that Anne declared last evening when we drank a bottle of 2005 Sagrantino, that it was one of the best bottles of wine she had ever tasted.
And you know, the thing is, I said it was also the kind of wine that I would like to drink every night.
But it's an unusual wine. There are many unusual wines in Italy. I guess this is one of the more unusual ones. Sagrantino, I think, is also the name of the grape variety.
Sagrantino is the name of grape variety. But and is our great vine is the historical grape of Montefalco. Montefalco is a little village in the center of Umbria, not too far from Spoleto, from Assisi, from Perugia. And the Sagrantino is arrived to us with the Franciscan monk more than 500 years ago. Very long story of the biodiversity of Italy and of the culture of the quality of Italy.
Now, Sagrantino as a grape, I have heard it's not the easiest grape from which to make wine. You have to really know what you're doing?
Yes, it's not too easy, but when you want to produce something of exceptional, nothing is too easy. The diversity, the unicity of Sagrantino is a big challenge for a producer of Umbria, and was my big challenge when I started more than 25 years ago.
Now, your father, you told us, actually founded the cantina and the vineyard?
And that was both the state, 1971, and gave me the possibility to work in wine and in the family since the 87.
Now, did you actually study winemaking as well, Marco?
And after I worked, Chloe was in the winery. I was also the director at the time, the director of the Consorzio di Tutela of Montefalco. And I worked for the DOCG of Sagrantino. My first project was the DOCG of Sagrantino that the government approved in 1990.
Okay, now we should perhaps explain that the wine we drank, 100% Sagrantino, is made only in very special vintages, and the one we had was 2005. The more available wine is called Montefalco Rosso, and I guess it's...
Montefalco Rosso is the first step of Montefalco. And it's a fantastic wine that you can drink every day.
Now, it's a blend, correct?
It's a blend of Sangiovese for 70%, 15% Sagrantino, and 15% Merlot.
Now, there's a stranger in there somewhere, right? Because Merlot is not a native Italian grape.
Merlot is not considered indigenous, but was present in Montefalco since the 19th century.
Okay,
wow.
So it's been there quite a long time. And it's, in a way, I guess, the super Tuscans of Toscana also contain Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon as well as
yes,
Sangiovese, correct?
Valcorosso, the DOC, is born in, was approved in 1979, before the Super Tuscan.
But I'm right in thinking that the Super Tuscans also used what would be considered exotic grapes in producing their wines too, correct?
Yes, because the most exposed is the Sangiovese, and after they, at the time, was very different than today. 30 years ago, the story of the Italian wine was very different than
right, right. Well, and you're one of the people who's helping to make that change. Now, I wanted to ask you to comment on something, because the Sangiovese grape is very widely grown in the region of Italy, generally called Toscana, but its characteristics are quite different depending on where you are. So, for example, a Chianti from the Colony Senesi will be very different than a Sangiovese from Scanzano, closer to the coast. And different again from perhaps one that's grown around Grosseto or that's grown around Montalcino. So is there something that makes the Umbrian Sangiovese different?
Our Sangiovese is more close to the Brunello style. Full body, elegant, with a good capacity to aging, not too heavy, with a good acidity. It's different to the Chianti. Chianti is more light than Montefalco, the Sangiovese. Sangiovese is very elastic grape, but in the same, we are in the center of Italy, we are in a continental weather, the summer it's hot, the precipitation was very, very low precipitation in summer, and we have a good condition to produce red wine with medium full body and good structure. Good capacity to
achieve. Now, I hope you will be impressed to know that one of the reasons that we invited you to join the program is that we did have the pleasure of drinking Montefalco Rosso when we were in Italy. Now, I can't remember when it was, but the name remained in my mind. So when
Alessandro
sent us the information, I said, you know, we really ought to try that. Interestingly enough, there's an American woman wine writer called Alice
Firing,
and she just wrote a book about making her own wine. I think it was called Naked Wine or something, or the Naked Grape.
Naked Grape.
And the wine she made in California was 100% Sagrantino grape grown in California.
Yeah, there are a lot of new Sagrantino producers, not only in California, also in Australia, also in Italy, in Sicily, in Tuscany.
Oh right, okay. So the grape is it's now catching on. Would you say?
But one time the Sagrantino was only a domestic grape. Today is a traveler grape, and he started the story of the Greek grape. He started, and many other producers want to try it. It's an interesting grape. One very very interesting for the color, for the structure, for the high level of polyphenol, antioxidant. It's very interesting grape for blend, like Montefalco Rosso, but it's very interesting grape alone. And have all the characteristics of the international grape, and I think that in the next year we can taste some new interesting wine made by Sagrantino to confront with the traditional Sagrantino.
Now, we're very fortunate, Marco, that you're in the United States, so you're talking to us now from New York, and you're over here for a special event, I think.
Yes, today, yes, there is a big tasting of the Italian wine today. In Italy, we have our most important wine guide is Vini d'Italia of Gambero Rosso, and today there is the tasting of all the top wine for the Gambero Rosso.
Great. Well, now that brings me to the next question, which is always an intriguing and challenging thing, but thanks to, I think, Michael Mondavi Wine Imports, your wines are coming into the United States, but how widely available are they?
Oh, more than 40 countries in the world, because Sagrantino today is one of the blue flag of the Italian indigenous grape, and in all the world there are an Italian good restaurant. Often the Italian good restaurant want to have an Italian wine list, and often in the wine list the Sagrantino is one of the first choice. Today you can drink the Sagrantino in many different countries, but also in the Far East, in Asia, in Japan, in China, in India, in Thailand. Sometimes was a very little quantity, but is for us is an incredible emotion to try the bottle also in a restaurant very far from Montefalco.
Now, I have just one last question, and Alessandro, you may be able to answer this better, I'm not sure, but can you estimate what the price point would be for the Montefalco Rosso and for the single variety Sagrantino in a typical retail outlet in the United States?
Yeah, on average, the Montefalco Rosso is available for the retail price for $22.99.
That's great.
And
okay.
The Sagrantino to the 25th anniversary is $400. But so that's the average price.
No wonder I like it.
We should have made it last for more than one night.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we thank you both for joining us. Alessandro, thank you for making the arrangement. Arnaldo,
thanks a lot for this call.
Yeah, Arnaldo Marco for being such a great spokesperson. The name of the wine again is Arnaldo, Arnaldo, and there's a hyphen in there, Caprai, Caprai, although I think that's the founder's first and last name. And I'm sure there must be a website that people can get further information. Let's just plug that in before we say goodbye.
Yeah, it's www.arnaldocapraiusa. So the name, arnaldocapraiusa.com.
Oh, that's good and that's straightforward.
Listeners, save your pennies. Save your pennies. The 25th anniversary wine is... as we said at the beginning, one of the best bottles of wine we have ever enjoyed, and we thank you so much for sharing this information with us today. Thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
And good luck at the wine tasting event.
And don't be the least bit surprised.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Anna.
And thank you. Have a great day.
And thanks, Alessandro.
Don't be surprised if we get in touch with you and say we're coming to see you in Umbria. And don't go away, because this break is timed for 16 seconds.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net. Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and as those of you who visited Italy know, I'm sure there are great wines in Italy, but one of the things Italy is also famous for is the breads and desserts, or dolci. So who better to tell us about that and how you can make them for yourself? Carol
Field,
the Italian baker.
Well, the first time around, the Italian baker was hailed as the ultimate baking book, and now we have Carol Field, the author, actually updating, and what is it, 30 years later, Carol?
Yes, almost 30 years later.
Okay, you're updating it, and that involves a lot with recipes, equipment, and probably additional research, I would imagine, too.
Yes, absolutely.
And it covers not just bread, I slipped on that one, it's breads, pizza, focaccia, cakes, pastries, and cookies. So that's the whole field of Italian baking.
It's everything that comes out of the baker's oven.
Okay, and then you carry it even further, talking about recipes, dishes you make with these ingredients, like your leftover bread.
That's right. Well, the Italians don't talk about stale bread. They think of bread having a new incarnation. It's just another opportunity to do something with bread. And so there's a long tradition of putting somewhat older bread in the bottom of a soup bowl.
Oh, yes.
And the bread gets moistened by the liquid of the soup, and both of them turn out to have a wonderful new taste. And in bruschetta and crostini, those sort of antipasti, they come from stale bread.
Now, Carol, let's jump back to when you first did this.
Sure.
You toured Italy for 2 years.
Even.
Collecting recipes. 3 years?
Yeah, two
three
and
years.
A half.
Okay. Collecting recipes out of cooks' kitchens, right?
No, actually out of bakers. Out of bakery.
Oh, okay. Artisanal, though.
Oh, artisanal, yes. But I learned from the Italian baking tradition. There was much more bread made in bakeries than there is in homes, you can imagine. People in the countryside made bread at home because they didn't have a nearby bakery. But the baking tradition in Italy started in Roman times, and they learned from the Greeks who they conquered. And in the Rome of the Empire, there were 329 bakeries in Rome. Wow, and they made all kinds of bread. You know, they made bread that was in various shapes. They made bread for each social class. So if you were a senator, you ate different breads than peasants did. And sometimes the breads were named for what they were eaten with. There was an oyster bread made. It's a huge, long tradition. It's a bakery tradition. So that's I learned by going to bakeries.
Now, what interested you in the baking anyhow, and for Italian baking?
Well, the first thing that interested me was going to Italy.
Okay.
I mean, falling in love with Italy, and then noticing that wherever we went, from region to region, the breads were totally different.
Well, yes. Everything, not just the breads,
no,
the sweets.
No, not just bread, the pastas, everything.
Pastas.
It's really because Italy, although it has a very long history, was not unified until
right.
about 150 years ago. And so regional traditions have carried through for all these hundreds of years.
And in fact, some people would say it's not unified yet.
and
they'd probably be right.
Yes, that's exactly true. And there's a part of me that doesn't want it to be because I want to preserve the food traditions. And, you know, once you start really unifying things, the borders become porous. And now, all over Italy, you can get ciabatta anywhere.
Uh-huh.
It started out around Lake Como and Lugano. But now, anywhere you go, of course, it doesn't have salt in it when you eat in Florence or Siena.
Yeah, we won't go through that story.
No, you're right.
But this, I mean, you would have had in 30 years quite a lot to update, even in traditional baking, right?
Yes.
Because you're dealing with different ingredient availability, you're dealing with different techniques. Just tell us roughly what kinds of things you looked to update.
Well, let's see. One of the first things I did was to make a recipe for almost natural yeast. I start my natural yeast with grains, dry active yeast, but you refresh it and refresh it, and in no time at all, it's never changed the taste, but it makes it easier to keep it a living thing. So that was the first thing I did. Then I looked at some recipes, and either I had been to different bakeries within the 25 years the book was in print. So I had those recipes to do, and some things I just had learned. So I changed those. And let's see, there are now metric and American measures for every ingredient in every recipe in this entire book.
Oh, wow, that's a work in and of itself,
terrible,
right?
Yeah.
It was unbelievable, and I hope never to have to go through that again. But it means, because I truly believe that when you're baking, you should weigh things. So it means there are cups and tablespoons and things, but I much prefer that people weigh their ingredients.
Oh, I think it's coming. I think everybody's starting to insist on that.
Yes. Well, at any rate, I felt as if I was in the vanguard. And, of course, there are more ingredients and more equipment available than that was true all those years ago. So, and there are people making flour from grain in the most meticulous way. So it's changed a lot. It's very interesting to me how much bread baking.
We interviewed Mark Vetri not so long ago, and he really spends a lot of time on the flours involved and how important they are.
It's true, and yet I want to say that I made this book for everybody in America. So everything in this book has been baked using flours that are easy to get across the country.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I want people who are living in the country to be able to bake as well as people who are living in larger cities where they can get different ingredients. And I have in my index to where you can buy things, I list where you can things like 00 flour for pizza. But I really, really wanted to open the field of baking to everybody.
I know that they're all your children, but talk to us about some of your most favorite recipes.
Well, let's see. In the bread department, I would have to say the ciabatta, the first ciabatta, because I have two ciabattas now in this book. Now, ciabatta has become such a universal bread in Italy that I wanted to include the new sort of modern ciabatta that is the wettest dough in this book. It has 90% hydration.
Wow.
So it's very wet, and you can't really shape it. You can pick it up and put it in the oven, but you can't, you just can't use your hands to give it a shape. You can fold it, and that's about it. So I wanted that. That's a new recipe in this book. And at the same time, the ciabatta that has a little bit of olive oil and a little bit of milk in the dough comes from the original book. I think it's one of the most delicious recipes in the book.
Is this the Polisana?
No, the Polisana is the new one. The regular ciabatta is just called ciabatta, slipper-shaped bread from Lake Como.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what it supposedly means. There it is. Ciabatta,
yeah.
I see. Ciabatta.
And then the next recipe is ciabatta Polisana, comes from the Veneto. And it was actually started, this recipe reached all around Italy because there's a man who was a very famous racing car driver, and he decided to give up racing and go and work with the flour from his family's mills, just the way Mark Vetri is really interested in different flours.
Arnaldo Cavallari?
That's exactly
yeah.
right.
All right, so that's your favorite bread.
And you know, I have to also talk about Pan Bigio.
Tell our listeners that I opened the book to exactly that page, and there had to have been some sort of a mental influence from you.
I love Pan Bigio, and Pan Bigio is really, if you had to have the herb bread of the countryside, it's a peasant bread. It has partly whole wheat and partly white flour, and it uses a starter. It's a delicious bread that is, if you had to sort of pick a representative mix of grains in Italy, you might say Pan Bigio is it.
And why the shape?
It's the normal round shape of bread. The two most standard shapes are round, and they can either be round and weigh a pound, or they can be round and literally weigh 10 kilos. But those are the breads that are for people who are going on long voyages on the sea, or they are shepherds and they need to take their bread with them as they take their flocks across. And they're still made. 10 kilo breads are still made, but round or the long, narrow shapes are the sort of traditional shapes.
And I see here that I've made this shape, pane siciliano, the occhi, eye.
That's right.
We used to make that shape with the cucciadada. I never thought of it as an eye.
Ah, well, in this case, because it's Sicilian, it's the eyes of Santa Lucia.
Yeah, well, that's when they pulled them out of her head.
Yeah, right. There's some
not very appetizing. No, I mean, Santa Lucia, and what's the St. Agnes are the two I don't like seeing the pictures
exactly.
of.
Exactly. No, exactly. They're really grisly. So in case you think bread is just something easy to think about, has no important, grisly story behind it, that would not be true.
Oh, dear. You have some sort of interesting recipes for using leftover breads. Talk to us about some of that, like panzanella.
Panzanella is
one of Peter's favorite things.
It's one of my absolutely favorite things. It uses leftover Tuscan bread. And the Italians don't think that leftover bread means it's stale. They think it's an opportunity for making a whole new range of dishes with the bread that you made two or three or four days ago.
But you don't have a rubella recipe.
No, you don't have that. Rubellita.
And promised she was going to make me some of that.
Yeah, rubellita.
I have an unbelievably good rubellita recipe in a different book that I wrote called In Nona's Kitchen.
Okay, that would be perfect.
It was. I mean, because it really is down-home grandmother's food. But here I have a minestrone instead, a Tuscan minestrone.
Uh-huh.
And the panzanella is Tuscan bread salad. And you simply soak the bread until it's moist, and then you squeeze it dry, and then you put in the bowl tomatoes and cucumbers and onions and celery and basil. It's not exactly one of those recipes that is written in stone. If you have some, I don't know, green onions or some green beans or whatever, you can add them to this salad. And then the Romans do. They put in capers and anchovies, garlic, hard-boiled eggs. But the Tuscans use the recipe, the ingredients I just mentioned. And then they make oil and vinegar and salt. You know, they just toss it with a salad dressing. And it is really delicious. And you'll see it all over Tuscany, particularly in the summertime.
And what about the sweets now? I mean, you must have some sweet favorites, too. There are plenty of them in Italy.
There are a lot of them in this book. I love the pear tart. The pears are poached in red wine that has some cloves, and the dough has a little bit of cornmeal in it, so it has a crunch. It has a texture to it. It's a delicious bread.
Now, do you have the ultimate cassata here?
Well, it's one.
I mean,
I know every Sicilian has the cassata that they grew up eating.
Exactly.
But this one is a good one, and it came from a wonderful bakery in Palermo.
Oh, well, that's the source of it, isn't it?
It is, and I love that one.
Yeah.
Let's see. I love the Amor Polenta, which is a cornmeal cake from the Lombardia, and it has a lot of butter, baked in a long, narrow shape. Absolutely delicious. If you serve it with fresh fruit or stewed fruit, even better. It's a wonderful. It has a special, delicate flavor, even though you wouldn't guess it from, you know, the fact that it has cornmeal in it.
Yeah, I always get a giggle over this Brutti Mabuoni.
Yeah.
Ugly, but good.
Good. And they're not distinguished when you look at them.
No, they're
but
not.
But they taste so delicious, and they're very easy to make. And I love the bolli di neve, the snowballs that are essentially almond paste that have candied orange peel.
Oh, no, that sounds good, doesn't it?
Huh? Delicious, and they're very easy to make. They really are. A lot of these cookies are easy to make.
That used to be our standard for Christmas, and all these different cookies, so it's, that to me is holiday and celebration.
I absolutely agree with you, and I was just thinking, next week is the week before Christmas, and I'm going to go into the kitchen.
Well, you better fly in and get working on these cucciatà that we are going to make.
They are hard to make, I know.
It does take a long time. Well, Carol, I think that this book came out at just the right time for everybody. If people are interested in exploring some more subtle variations, you have plenty of those. And you also have the really big, bold flavors of Italy's baked goods here.
Yes, that was the intention. I wanted to give a real sense of the gamut of Italian flavors and all of the regional specialties.
Well, you did that.
Well, and thank you.
I think the cover's gorgeous, too. I could jump right into that loaf of bread, the ciabatta.
I know. It makes people hungry. I'm delighted to say.
Yes, I bet. Well, congratulations on a successful project here.
Thank you.
The first time around and the revision the second time around.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for talking to us.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Carol.
And I just checked and I told a little white lie. The break is actually 20 seconds in duration.
I said I thought it was longer
than
16.
Well, the difference between 16 and 20 is really the batting of
an
eyelid or something like that.
Four.
Anyway, it's time to go to break now.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
here we are again, as are cast iron pots.
Well, we're actually finishing up the program today with pots and dishes.
Yes, but
first up, a fascinating story of a hugely successful all-American enterprise that's been making cast iron pots for cooking for well over 100 years. Lodge Manufacturing from not Pittsburgh, but South Pittsburgh in the great state of Tennessee.
Well, we're talking about a subject very close to my heart with the company's director of advertising and marketing, Mark Kelly. Mark, I adore cast iron cookery, and I'm so glad it's back in style. I guess it never has gone out of style, huh?
It struggled a little bit for a good while after World War II. And then in 2002, we started Foundry Seasoning our cookware. And
why I wanted to try your cookware. I forgot. I want to see what that does.
It's essentially a starter kit after you cook with it a time or two. It's very well seasoned. We spray a vegetable oil on the cookware here at our foundry, and it's baked on at high temperatures and packed and ready to go.
And they become stick-free or whatever you call them. And then they don't stick. They're non-stick.
Yeah, they don't stick, and as long as you maintain it and cook with it all the time, it'll maintain its seasoning. Very soon thereafter, in 2002, we won the Good Housekeeping Goodbye Award for product innovation, and it's been virtually non-stop sales since then, and the past 4 years have been our best years ever, and each year gets progressively better. The first 2 months of 2012 have been outstanding, and so we're, as I often say, all the cast iron gods have aligned.
Well, I think what's been happening is people have been rediscovering the existence of these pots, or the idea that this is a great cooking method, and I've been reading about it in Esquire magazine, how should a man cook a steak? And
yes.
The answer is you cook it exactly the same way I did last night, which is you get your cast iron skillet as hot as you possibly can, and you throw the steak in there, and you char it on the outside, and then you stick it in the oven to finish.
And so why can't I get the pot clean or the pan clean?
That's because of what I did afterwards.
Oh, I see.
I transferred the steak to a pan in the stove, and I cooked some onions with leftover marinade in the cast iron skillet, and I think it wasn't as pre-seasoned as a large one would be.
Simple to take care of that. Just put a little water in there and let it get to a low boil, and that should remove all those things. And then I would recommend putting some olive oil all over your cookware.
We do that all the time, and I just got to get the encrustation off.
Yeah. Now I understand that everybody's been tweeting about this, that flaxseed oil is the best way to season these cast iron pots.
It's a very good oil. We started the seasoning process here. We looked at just a wide variety of oils, and essentially what we do is we use an electrostatic spray to create positive and negative ions so that the oil adheres to the cast iron. Flaxseed did not work in our process. But if you want to go back and reseason your cookware or start maintaining it with flaxseed, that works perfectly fine. I personally prefer olive oil. A real good friend of ours on the West Coast has a whole series of skillets that he has seasoned with duck fat for a real smoky flavor. Season and maintain your cookware is as varied as the individual taste of what you like to cook.
And it's all outlined. The reason we're actually talking to you today is that you have this, I got very excited about this, the Lodge Cast Iron Cookbook. And not only is it a reference go-to book on cast iron and its functions, I mean, you talk about using it outside, cooking with it on the grill. You talk about, what's that thing with the hole?
Beanhole cooking. That's a very old cooking technique with cast iron Dutch ovens. And essentially, it was created during the progress across the country where people were out either working on the farm or hunting or foraging, and you dig a hole in the ground, and you put several pots in there with hot coals, and when you come back, and then you put a cover on it, and you come back at the end of the day, and all your food's prepared.
But this cookbook has not only all these great instructions and bits of information, but it also has wonderful recipes, including an entire chapter on cornbread?
Yes, in most people's minds, and there are several Bible references as well, the only way to cook cornbread is with cast iron cookware. And that's a joke about the biblical references. But
the Leviticus you quoted, right? What was that?
That was in Bon Appetit. That was on the dishwasher thing.
Oh, yeah. Anybody who puts their cast iron skillet in the dishwasher goes straight to hell.
Yeah, it's in Leviticus. But but really, we've been so fortunate with all that that, you know, it makes a lot of sense. But the hallmark of the cookbook, it really is that we were able to communicate with cooks and chefs and cookbook authors all over the country to submit their recipes and their sidebars about their personal history with cast iron cookery. And
yeah, I like that. I like the story parts.
Yeah, and they're, you know, all of them are wonderful. Some of them are extremely touching, and it just gives you a sense, the timeless sense of cast iron, not just now, but through the ages and for the future. And we patterned that a little bit after a book we produced 8 years ago called A Skilletful, and those are primarily Southern recipes, but the great thing about the cast iron cookbook is, the Lodge cast iron cookbook is vegetarian recipes. We have recipes on the grill, on the stovetop, in the oven, campground, and it just shows the versatility and the durability of the cookware, and people are really responding to it just the way we anticipated, and we've received hundreds of emails and Facebook posts about the cookbook and how much they're enjoying it, and that they didn't realize all the things you can do with cast iron cookware. And I'm stealing a line from the movie Field of Dreams, but if you can think it, you can cook it with cast iron cookware. And the main thing is, don't be afraid of it, because it's a very forgiving piece of cookware, and if you treat it nice, it'll treat you nice as well.
Peter had a question.
Well, the most amazing thing, to my mind, aside from this absolutely amazing book and the whole concept of cooking with cast iron, which we've been doing for years, is that...
Oh, could I interject something here?
Yeah, of course you can.
When you said we've been doing this for years, my obstetrician said he had never had a pregnant woman with such a high hemoglobin count. And I think it's because I've cooked for years with cast iron.
That's exactly true. There have been lots of surveys of people who... particularly in third world countries, but also here, people who cook with cast iron are infinitely healthier, at least they have a higher iron count, than people that don't. And before the introduction of other metals into the cookware market, there were no incidents of anemia in our country. And so they've done, the World Health Organization and UNICEF have done surveys on third world countries in third world villages, and the villages that cook with cast iron are infinitely healthier than the villages that do not.
But you have an easy job.
Because I guess it depends what they cook with instead, I guess. But I had a question. Sometimes I don't get a word in edgeways here, but
I'm tossing it to
that
you.
Sounds like I now got a chance. One of the most remarkable aspects of the Lodge story is that this is a U.S.-based enterprise based in East Pittsburgh, which they don't
South
know.
Pittsburgh. South Pittsburgh, Tennessee.
South Pittsburgh, which they don't know how to spell down there.
But they when they were starting the town, they wanted it to be a little bit different than the North Pittsburgh. But it was you know, they were starting foundries here, and it's an interesting thing. There was iron and coal in the mountains here, and they were really gearing up, and then they found a pure strain of ore in Bessemer, Alabama, or Birmingham, and Birmingham actually became the Pittsburgh of the South.
Okay, so it sort of took over from a tradition of making iron things in Tennessee, going
yes,
way back.
Some entrepreneurs and industrialists from the UK came to the States and were looking for coal and iron in the mountains or in whatever region, and they found this, and there were a couple of foundries here. One stayed here a lot longer than the others. That was U.S. Stove Company. They now make all their products overseas, and we're the last foundry standing, and we've been here 116 years, and looks like we'll be around for another 116 years or more.
Well, that's the point that I wanted to make. I mean, we hear people are opining. There you go. Expressing an opinion that it's not possible to manufacture things in the United States anymore because our costs are too high, and besides, we don't know how to do that. And it's wonderful to find a company like Lodge, which proves that that's a whole lot of hogwash.
It really is. I mean, there's so many factors involved, but we're a family-owned company. We've never been union-owned. Our benefits plan is great. Our product is the best in the world, and we have a legion of followers all over the world that believe in our product and pitch it as much as they can. Cast Iron Cookery is having a really great renaissance at the stage now where we can't make our product fast enough. So we're looking at possibly expanding our foundry in the next couple of years. But,
well, that's great. Now you've deviated a little bit from the pure cast iron with the handle that gets super hot because you're heating the whole thing up. And so you've made some innovations as well, and you're doing things with stainless steel as well as cast iron, I think.
Yeah, we have a line of cast iron with stainless steel handles. We introduced those in 2007. It's called the Signature Series. The handles on the skillets and grill pans remain cool touch on the stovetop. Nobody had ever riveted stainless steel handles to cast iron before, so we won two design awards from the Housewares Association. The first one was in the cookware and bakeware category. The second one was for best in show, and that included electronics and all types of other categories. It didn't matter if it was these whiz-bang vacuum cleaners with computers in it, or electric gillet, or a TV, or any of those other things. That product, that handle design, was the number one in the housewares industry that year. We continue to come out with new products in just the season line of cast iron. We have a new line called the Tableware Series, which are small mini servers for the restaurant trade. They're also used in homes, and a lot of campers use them for cooking and serving vessels when they're hiking or canoeing or whatever outdoors. So we're always coming up with new products. The only way to stay in business is to be innovative and creative and find what your customers are looking for, and we continue to do that. But it's truly remarkable. Our 10 and 12 inch skillets have been our most popular pieces since Joseph Lodge started the company 116 years ago, and those are still our two most popular items, and every year the sales of those continue to increase dramatically.
Well, Peter was asking why. Go ahead.
Yeah, I sort of think I know. It's called old-fashioned family values and a well-run business. Isn't that the answer?
It is. You know, we're a throwback company. We receive a lot of interesting perks. I mean, every 100 days we don't have a lost time accident in the foundry. We have a banquet. We have profit sharing every quarter, and I can't remember the last time we didn't get profit sharing check. We receive a turkey at Thanksgiving and a ham at Christmas. We have a scholarship fund through the owners for children or even an employee that's selected every year. It's the Kellerman Brothers Scholarship. And we're real active in the community in a lot of ways. We support our local Boy Scout troop. We co-sponsor the National Cornbread Cook-Off with Martha White Cornmeal. That cookbook that I referenced earlier, Skilletful, for every cookbook that we've sold of that, a dollar goes to our local preservation society, and we've sold over 180,000 copies of that book, which has been real instrumental in restoring an old movie theater here.
Let me just underline it for listeners. The owners were not interested in selling out to Bain Capital.
No.
I think we get the message. Now we just need to wind up with, you told us that you can buy the book and you can buy Lodge cookware through lots and lots of outlets, but is there a central place where people can go on a website where they can find out what the most convenient places for them to go buy?
You can buy virtually anything of Lodge on Amazon.com or LodgeMFG.com. We're also at Walmart, Target, and Bass Pro Shop. But we're Sur-La-Tab and Williams-Sonoma stores. And the one thing that I can't emphasize enough, and anybody who works here, we have 220 employees here. It is a family-owned business, but the one thing, anytime we have discussions on our growth, and we are growing a lot, and how to adapt to that, the one thing everybody says, and pretty much everybody gives an amen to that, is never lose the family atmosphere. It's an amazing place, and it's a beautiful area of the world, and we're extremely proud to have this wonderful new cookbook and have 120 items that we make here in South Pittsburgh, Tennessee, and our fans and customers are very loyal.
Well, Mark, again, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu, and we'll look forward to checking in with you 116 years from now and find out if you're still doing the job the way you said you would be.
We'll be sautéing, searing, braising, stir-frying all the way through the years.
Well, keep it up. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And don't miss today's final segment right after this short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and I'm going to introduce you to a name that I'd like to own for my very self, Shax. Isn't that a great name?
Yeah, but Shax Haig wouldn't sound too good.
Shax Haig. I don't know. It sounds pretty good to me.
Oh, come on, come on.
Anyhow, here's a book you're going to love, too. It's all about dishes.
And remarkably, you can understand what a great book it is without even looking at the pages. But I anticipate that in order to have the full enjoyment of this great work, you'll want to get yourself a copy so you can look at the pictures.
Pete is asking permission to do an introduction this time. I don't get to do it very often, but I'm always one for the obscure. So I was delighted to learn from our next guest that there's a paper plate in the collection of the Tate Modern in London, I guess, although there is more than one Tate Modern in the United Kingdom. It's a paper plate that's rather special, and our guest found it. Maybe he's even got one of his own. His first name is Shax, and his last name's not in front of me because Anne's hiding it from me.
No, his last name is
Shax
Riegler.
Riegler. Shax Riegler.
And his middle name is Frederick, is it?
Yeah.
Shax Frederick Riegler.
And welcome to the program, and thank you for this masterpiece of trivia.
Thank you. You're welcome.
It's really a sound historical study of something we maybe don't think of very often. It's called Dish, and it says 813 colorful, wonderful dinner plates. Welcome to On the Menu, Shax.
Thank you.
We've had great fun with your book.
Oh, good.
Recognizing.
Well, we've had great fun in this interview already.
Yeah.
Listeners, you missed the best part. You should have tuned in earlier.
But it's like, it's a history of, it's a social history, it's a culinary history. Give us just a brief rundown on how you got involved with this, with plates and porcelain and so forth.
Well, I think that people often sort of feel an affinity towards a certain material, and I always have felt some connection to ceramics and porcelain throughout my life, really. I've worked at many magazines in the past, in my career, and lifestyle magazines, and you do a lot of stories on entertaining.
Yeah, like House Beautiful, House and Garden, Martha Stewart Living,
yes.
Travel and Leisure, and Vogue. And these are all top-notch style magazines, lifestyle magazines.
Yeah, so I've gotten into a lot of interesting houses and met some really interesting people and seen the way tables get set in many different kinds of locations. But I just always was interested in ceramics, and one day just realized that you could look at plates and the different patterns on plates for a long time and not necessarily start repeating yourself, because there are thousands, really there are thousands I could have chosen from for the book.
You don't do just a historical rundown on this. You break it down into topics, right?
Yeah, we decided not to do the sort of typical historical approach, which would have really been just lay it out chronologically.
Which you do in a sense, I mean, in that banner underneath.
Well, there is a timeline, yes,
timeline
at the beginning that's sort of, it's just sort of fun, that's a lot of trivia, just fun moments in history from the Renaissance up to this year, really, of just sort of innovations or things that have happened. But the bulk of the book, we decided to take an approach, a thematic approach. So there are six chapters that are really broad categories of the kinds that we could break tableware down into these categories. So there's elegance and tradition, which is where you will find the really traditional, famous, gilded pieces. And then there's a more modern section called color and form. And there's a section on art and craft, which is about folk pottery and also fine artists who've designed plates over time. And then there's a chapter on flora and fauna, which is just about animal, flowers, vegetable motifs on plates, people and places, which is obvious, and then holidays and celebrations, which is about all the plates made for specific holidays or special occasions.
Right. Now, you start out with a description of these dish queens. And, you know, I never knew there was a term, but I know dish queens.
Go on. Who's going to tell me what a dish queen is? I'll pretend I can't guess.
Well, at that particular...
Not what you're thinking.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the book. It's sort of a tongue-in-cheek warning about the danger of reading this book, that it could induce dish mania or turn you into a dish queen. But the idea is just people, and I met a lot of them in the course of this book, who are not satisfied with just one or two sets of china, but they have a lot. They find them at flea markets, or they, you know, they find new ones. But it's actually, it's an old sort of malady that I sort of
I didn't realize that. It goes back a long way.
Yeah, back in the 1600s.
Henry Francis DuPont.
Well, yeah, he was a great collector, but going back hundreds of years, there were people who were sort of mocked for collecting too much china, like Queen Mary of England in the 1690s. The writer Daniel Defoe, who's, you know, wrote Robinson Crusoe, criticized her for spending too much money on porcelain.
Who was the one? I like the one who threw the dishes into the river to demonstrate that he, you know, just how wealthy he was. And then after all the guests left, he had put a net underneath and caught them all. Who was that?
That's this Renaissance banker in Rome named Agostino Chigi. And he threw a big dinner party at his villa on the river. And he wanted his guests to know how rich he was. So he threw all of the dishes into the river after each course. And those dishes were actually made of silver.
Wow.
So then every course would have a whole new setting, but then the joke is that after everyone left, his servants pulled the dishes out of the river because there was a net there collecting them.
That was very, very clever, I think.
They wanted everyone to know how rich he was.
Right.
We now know how he got that rich.
Exactly.
But, you know, there's this trend here that I noticed it with silverware, too. I have old sets of silverware where there were special pieces for things that you would never think of. You wrote about this asparagus plate, you know. Well, I have an asparagus server. Have you seen they had the pea pushers?
Oh, you have asparagus plates, too.
Asparagus plates?
No,
I have artichoke plates.
Artichoke.
Well, no, they're very important. You have to have that little well and everything.
You do, okay.
I saw that in here. I can't remember. It's so green, you know what I mean?
There's an oyster plate. There's several oyster plates in here.
Yeah, no, I meant this kind of, you didn't have the artichoke plate, but you had the same kind of china stuff. It looks like leaves on top of each other.
Oh, it could be. It's probably a majolica, 1930.
Probably, yeah. Artichokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, I love setting a table. I love putting funny things in for centerpieces. But where are we going to go from here? I mean, it does this anymore.
Well, I think that the idea is there's this fear that people don't sit down to eat dinner anymore. And maybe they don't on a daily basis because, you know, families are so busy and everyone's off doing their, you know, after school or after work activities. But I think the art of setting the table still appeals to a lot of people, and brides are still registering for their china patterns and things like that. And I hope that people are actually still using it. I mean, it's sad to think that a lot of the stuff was purchased and then kept in a cupboard and never brought out.
Yeah, I know somebody who will never use the same set of dishes in the same week. She has an actual room that's it's like a pantry, just filled with nothing but dishes.
Well, that's really rarefied. But Yeah, people who have a lot of, like a house with an old butler's pantry or something with lots of storage, it's great because if you buy these dishes and you have a place to keep them that's accessible, then you can use them. A lot of the people, dish queens or whoever that I borrowed things from, some of them, they're in the basement in boxes or they're stuffed in closets, in the back of closets and stuff. So they bought them, but they never use them because they're so tucked away. You actually, it's too much effort to go dig them out.
Well, mainly you can't put most of them in the dishwasher, which I learned the hard way.
Yeah.
Especially gold-edged things.
Yeah, anything gilded is probably not dishwasher safe. Especially anything really pre-1970s is not really dishwasher. I mean, you know, it can survive being in the dishwasher, but it's not good for it because the heat, the temperature in the dishwasher is really bad, can be bad for plates and the decoration on them, and the detergent in the dishwasher can actually
make that's
harsh. Yeah.
But that takes the finish off of all clad cookware.
Exactly, I know. I learned that the hard way.
Yeah, I did too.
So did Anya. She did too. She had these wonderful dark anodized pans.
Yeah.
They're now sort of scratchy looking light gray.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, you have some too.
Yeah.
Well, now, picture this. We do have this problem, is that this book is so gorgeously illustrated, and there are so many pictures and things to look at, and here we are on radio.
Yes.
How do we overcome this problem and explain to our listeners why to rush out and get this book?
Because they can't see the pictures if they don't. That's easy.
Do you have a particular, when you were flipping through, did you have any pattern that struck you, you know, that you just loved?
Well, I told you, Bunnykins was missing.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. I have that the stuff with the gold edge.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, I guess the things that I was most interested in were the artist design ones and the fashion designer ones. They're pretty cool.
The fashion designer ones, you know, I have a plate by Ralph Lauren and Vera Wang and Kate Spade and Calvin Klein. They all kind of branched into houseware in the past few decades. But a lot of the China companies work with those designers because it's a nice branding thing. You go to the China department at your department store and you see nice dishes made by Wedgwood that were designed by Vera Wang or made by Lennox that were designed by Kate Spade. But it's interesting because it helps because people are familiar with with those names and they think, oh, they're an important fashion designer, they have good taste. But it's really interesting because that's not new. Like going back to the 1700s, Josiah Wedgwood, when he founded Wedgwood, was also kind of going to the tastemakers of his day, aristocratic ladies in England, and getting them to endorse his wares so that people who were following, you know, the fashions and knew about these noble ladies would then say, oh, well, Lady so-and-so has this pattern, so it must be good.
Uh-huh.
And when he invented his big invention, creamware, which is this lovely white, creamy white body of clay, Queen Charlotte bought it. And she ordered so much of it that he then started calling it queensware.
Oh.
So he jumped right up. He knew before anybody knew, know, that having this sort of mark of a, you know, famous endorsement was really good for business. So it's funny, we think that's a modern idea, but
I thought that flow blue stuff.
Yeah.
I thought that was cheap stuff.
Yeah, you never liked it.
I never liked it at all. We had some of that, I think.
Yeah.
We're probably ready to break that.
It's definitely, yeah, it's an acquired taste. I've always been surprised at how popular it is. It's really, really collectible. And people who love it, love it.
Well, I think it's because people can recognize it without having to turn the plate over.
What is your favorite, Jax?
Well, it's hard because after doing this book, it's hard to pick one favorite. I mean, I kind of fell in love with some of the stranger pieces.
Like what?
Since doing the book, I started buying up something called Cornishware.
Oh, I just, we have relatives in Cornwall, and I was telling Peter about this. I've never seen it in Cornwall.
Oh. So that, I love that. It's very simple, though. I mean, it's just got that blue sort of, you know, stripe around the band.
I like that, though, because they had some knockoffs of that I was buying at the supermarket at one point.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but we broke all those plates, too.
One of the sections that I fell in love with the pieces while I was putting it together was the children's sets section, which doesn't have bunnykins in it.
But you have, you don't even have the Beatrix Potter stuff, and that's nice.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the Wedgwood Beatrix Potter stuff I didn't put in either. I guess it was hard to...
Well, I saved all of this stuff for our grandchildren, and so the first one was born, and I gathered together a set and took it down. I don't know how many sets I got when Adam was born. And, I mean, they were very polite about it, but they're not using this stuff. No more did they use baby silver. I mean, I still have my baby spoon, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they use plastic stuff and sippy cups and things.
Exactly. I mean, maybe that's why so much of this stuff survives. But it's amazing. There's some really old pieces in the book, like from the 1820s.
Well, here's a revelation. I found people using, especially Western people, using this Piero Fornasetti.
Yes.
That face as a logo. And with all kinds of fabulous stories going around it. And here I found out that this comes from an old, tell me the story about this image of the gal with the big dark eyes. And
yes, well, Piero Fornasetti was an Italian designer, and he saw a picture, like an old woodcut picture in an old French fashion magazine of an Italian soprano named Lina Cavalieri, and he just fell in love with her face. And he took that original image, and then he just started making variations on it. And the resulting pattern collection is now called Themes and Variations. And it exists on a bunch of products, but it's over 350 plates.
Holy Moses.
And he just took her face and he played with it. And I just show a few of them in the book. But, you know, like one is of her pressed against glass. One strange one is of her with, like, sort of cake.
Yeah, I thought that was very odd.
In her face.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a very iconic design. And that really crosses the line of not really meant to be used. It's an art object that you would buy and display. I mean, I suppose someone could use it. You could eat it as a plate. You could eat off of it if you want to. But I mostly know a lot of people who have just bought lots of the different variations and then, you know, hung them on the wall or something.
Well, there are a whole bunch of things that you could use for your next book. You don't have any of that French stuff that has the lizards on it and everything and snake.
Oh, the palace you wear.
Yeah, you don't have any of that in here. So you have a whole other... I know people who collect that. It's disgusting stuff.
Yeah.
So you have a whole other book here, but in the meantime, Shaz, let's remind people again, it's a dish, and the author is Shax, S-H-A-X, Riegler, R-I-E-G-L-E-R, and you've done a great job, and the photography is wonderful also in this book, so you must be very proud of it.
Great, I am. I think it's, I'm very pleased with the way it turned out.
Right.
Hope people like it.
I think they will. I think you're going to really start a lot of mania for planes. So, anyhow, I thank you for talking to us and keep us posted.
Okay, thank you so much.
I'd also like the one with the carrots. I like simple things like that.
Oh, yeah, that's really cute. That's nice.
So, Shax, thank you.
Thank you.
And as Bugs Bunny would say, that's all, folks. Until next week.
Bye-bye.